Stop whatever you're doing right now and listen carefully. I'm Oliver North, and this War Stories podcast is only for those who admire American heroes. Got it? Good. Stay tuned. On 1 April 1945, Allied armies were closing in on Berlin. Hitler's Nazi Germany was in its death throes, but the brutal war in the Pacific was far from over. It was Easter Sunday, and two U.S. Marine and two U.S. Army divisions began landing on the island of Okinawa, a must-hold bastion of Tokyo's Imperial Army. For President Harry Truman and his war planners, Okinawa was an essential stepping stone for invading the Japanese home islands and ending the war. The Emperor's order to his 155,000 troops on Okinawa was simple: fight to the death. Once ashore, American troops described the fighting on Okinawa as a typhoon of steel and the most ghastly corner of hell. The three-month-long battle claimed the lives of more than 12,000 Americans and wounded nearly 46,000. At sea, waves of suicidal Japanese kamikazes attacked 368 U.S. ships and amphibious craft and sank 36, killing nearly 5,000 sailors and wounding an equal number, the highest naval losses of any campaign since the opening days of World War II. In this podcast, you'll hear Marine Private Dan Barton and Army PFC Herman Buffington describe what it was like to fight an enemy that used civilians as human shields and wanted to die while killing Americans. Sound familiar to what we're facing today? Listen to Navy gunner Larry Dulewski. He survived repeated kamikaze attacks aboard the USS Laffey, an American destroyer, and somehow lived to tell you about things he never told his family. Okinawa was the last battle of World War II. The bloodshed on this island helped convince President Harry Truman to drop two atomic bombs so he wouldn't have to invade the Japanese home islands. If you're not inspired by the American heroes in this podcast, you should seek immediate medical attention.
Good evening, I'm Oliver North, and this is War Stories. How do you fight an enemy so dangerous, so desperate, he's literally willing to kill himself in order to destroy you? You fight to the death, that's how. On the island of Okinawa, that's exactly what the soldiers, sailors, and Marines did in a gut-wrenching final showdown with Japanese forces in the spring of 1945. This is the story of what was to be the last battle of World War II, the bloodiest conflict in the Pacific theater. With over 12,600 Americans killed, 45,000 wounded, and where 100,000 Japanese soldiers and an equal number of Okinawan civilians died. This would become Japan's brutal last stand against overwhelming American force. At sea, ferocious fighting between American ships and suicidal kamikaze pilots killed more sailors than any other battle, including Pearl Harbor. And on land, one soldier called the battleground the most ghastly corner of hell he'd ever witnessed. Spring, 1945. The tide of war had turned, but it wasn't over yet. 1 year earlier at Normandy, Allied forces invaded, putting Hitler on the defensive in Europe.
Much bitter fighting remains to be done, but the beginning has successfully been made.
Across the Pacific, Hirohito's time was also running out. Fighting the Allies for 3 years had taken a heavy toll on the Japanese Army, Navy, and Air Force. Marines raised the flag on Mount Suribachi at Iwo Jima, a bloody victory costing almost 7,000 American lives. An airbase near mainland Japan was secured.
Stay on the job and give the axis the axis.
Back at home, the war effort was in full swing. Women were on the job, filling in for the 16 million American men in uniform.
What will the decision be? Peace or war?
America was waging war on two fronts against the deadly Axis powers. Both Germany and Japan refused to give in. Casualties mounted. Over 1 million Americans were dead or wounded.
The war is speeding up. But for those who think it's over, let them ponder this.
Our armed forces desperately needed reinforcements, and young Americans lined up to serve.
At 17, I decided that that was the biggest show in the world, and I was going to have to somehow be part of it. I volunteered for the Raiders, and to my surprise, they accepted me.
Dan Barton's two older brothers were Marines. In 1943, he continued the family tradition and became a Marine Raider, fighting an enemy some said couldn't be beaten.
I remember when I went out to the Pacific, many people telling me that, hey, you guys are too soft. You're not going to beat the Japanese.
Larry Dulewski joined the Navy and requested sea duty.
I was a kid right out of high school. I was 19. High school friends had been killed in North Africa. My high school line coach was killed in the South Pacific.
Herman Buffington celebrated his 19th birthday with the 96th Infantry Division.
On my birthday, my foxhole to foxhole network set up and sang happy birthday to me.
These young men, boys really, would join hundreds of thousands of others for the fight of their lives, the D-Day of the Pacific, on an island 360 miles off the coast of Japan, Okinawa, the Emperor's doorstep.
It was the door to Japan, and they knew that as well, even better than we did.
The Japanese government, after the fall of Iwo Jima, knew that the Americans were obviously going to strike at Okinawa. They also knew that once Okinawa fell, it was only a matter of time before the invasion of mainland Japan.
Okinawa, the most strategic point invaded thus far.
Its proximity to Japan's main islands and its airfields made Okinawa strategically critical to the Allied plan. Get an unconditional Japanese surrender, even if they had to go all the way to Tokyo to get it. The island is 60 miles long, populated with farmers. Its hilly terrain honeycombed with caves, tunnels, and tombs.
Because of the large civilian population that had inhabited the island for centuries, there was turtleback tombs made of stone that's part of the Okinawan culture. They're burial vaults.
General Simon Bolivar Buckner, son of a Confederate general, would lead the 10th Army's massive amphibious assault of Okinawa, Operation Iceberg.
He was physically in superb shape. He could take coal, he could take exercise, he was tough as nails, but entirely different when he's working with men. He had a great deal of concern for them, and they liked him.
An avid outdoorsman, Buckner and his young son Bill went on a last fishing trip before the war.
We were close. As close as you can be, he was awfully busy. We went had a glorious fishing trip together in Alaska in 1941, just before the war, catching huge rainbow trout.
On the other side, leading the Japanese 32nd Army in Okinawa, General Mitsuru Ushijima, a senior member of Imperial Headquarters, he'd assembled one of the most effective combat teams in Japanese history.
Lieutenant General Ushijima was a very capable commander. He was relatively small in stature, and he was a type of leader that would allow his staff to prepare plans and so forth, and then he would ratify them.
Soon American troops are to land here, preceded by an immense bombardment.
March 1945. Attacks from the air and sea soften up the opposition on Okinawa. American naval gunfire and bombing are so intense, the Japanese call it a typhoon of steel. Over 1,400 ships carrying hundreds of thousands of men across the vast Pacific, a logistical nightmare for General Buckner.
Logistics were a huge problem, and there were those in his staff said, we can't do it. And his answer, I was told, was, you can't take that position.
Navy gunner Larry Dulewski was aboard one of the ships, the USS Laffey, a destroyer. The warship traveled all the way from Normandy to attack Okinawa.
That Pacific Ocean is big. You go for days and days and days and don't see anything but water. Yeah, it's big.
Army Private First Class Herman Buffington was amazed at the size of the armada.
Of course, we were on board ship for about 30 days. They had so many ships there, it looked like a city. As far as you could see, it was just ships.
Their leaders were brutally honest. Based on other Pacific battles, the men were told to expect horrific casualties.
For the last 2 weeks, we had briefings of all time. Now, here, an 18-year-old kid, and they were asking us if we had drawn up our will.
That's Ernie Pyle on board, the beloved war correspondent who spent much of the war in Europe with the troops. Now he was with Marines the night before the invasion.
April 1st, 1945, Easter Sunday, April Fool's Day, and L-Day, landing day for Operation Iceberg. I spoke to Marine historian Bennis Frank, who was there with the 1st Marines.
When you were making the landing in Okinawa, it turned out to be the last major battle of World War II.
Yes.
But it wasn't thought that it was going to be, was it?
Oh, no. I didn't know when I was going to go home. I fully expected once Okinawa was done, we were going to go on to Japan, in which case I didn't think I'd come home alive.
They started playing music. It was Easter Sunday. And some of you folks don't remember the very popular song, The Easter Parade. And this was on. And I remembered when we got into the landing craft, we started into the beaches, and you could hear it as long as you possibly could. It just got weaker and weaker, and no one was saying a thing.
The Japanese weren't sure when it was going to happen. They knew it was going to happen. They were aware that it was coming, and they were developing their contingency plans accordingly.
In Japanese, kamikaze means divine wind. And for a sailor unlucky enough to see one up close, it could mean certain death. With over 2,000 kamikaze planes designated to take out Navy ships, 5,000 American sailors wouldn't live to tell the tale. We'll meet one Navy gunner who beat the odds next on War Stories.
April 1st, 1945, landing day on Okinawa. 180,000 soldiers and Marines in the assault in the final battle of World War II.
When you were preparing for the landing, did you know that you were going to land at these beaches?
No.
Describe for us just exactly how the landing went, if you would, on the map.
There's a river, the Higuchi River, and on the right-hand side was 24th Corps. On the left-hand side was the 3rd Amphibious Corps. On the border was the 1st Division, and the 6th Division was on extreme left.
For the men of the 10th Army, the landing at Higuchi Beach turned out to be a surprise.
It turned out to be different than what we expected. Because of the heavy casualties at Peleliu and Iwo, we were expecting very heavy casualties in the first wave, the first number of waves. And when we walked ashore, there was nothing. We just walked on.
Nobody could understand what was going on. It couldn't be that easy. You know, something's up here, you know. And we were kind of, it was casualty, but we were kind of having a piece of cake.
The soldiers and Marines landed with ease. Instead of an ambush at the beach, the Japanese Army seemed practically AWOL on Okinawa.
It was like nobody was there. And the Marines peeled to the north, and the Army divisions cut across and bisected the island and then turned south.
The 6th Marine Division, which I was in, our objective was the northern end. They gave us 90 days to secure it, but we secured it in 21 days.
At sea, a very different story. The Japanese unveiled a lethal new weapon against the 5th Fleet, the kamikaze suicide plane, sent out on a one-way ticket to hell.
The kamikazes rained total terror and hell in the battle for Okinawa.
Well, it's a frightening thing. It's a frightening thing because you know what they can do. You're not talking about getting hit with ping pong balls. You're talking about a plane comes in with somebody aiming it to make sure it goes where they want it to go. It's loaded with gasoline. You get very intense fires. You know that it's going to be really destructive. You know that you do anything you can to avoid being hit.
The weapon is not extraordinary, but the will behind it is.
The kamikaze training in Japan was limited. All they needed to know how to do was take off, steer the plane, and that was it. In most cases, they would have a farewell. They would drink sake in a toast, a farewell toast. And they were totally committed, for one, but they also had the resolve to follow through with it because they looked at it as they were going to become venerated heroes. They were protecting mainland Japan, their loved ones, from the eventual invasion.
This latest disclosure of Jap suicide attacks shows a battleship and an aircraft carrier hit by diving kamikazes.
Off the coast, Navy gunner Larry Dulewski witnessed several kamikaze attacks from the destroyer Laffey.
When we could actually see the pilot in there and then see his neckerchief floating in the breeze, you know, and he'd go hit a ship that was alongside him. He wasn't looking for you. He was looking for somebody else.
Aircraft carriers were the kamikaze's main targets. They eventually sank some 34 other ships by the end of the battle. But picket ships like the Laffey, positioned to take out Japanese planes, also drew their suicidal rage. The sailors could feel it coming.
We saw so many things happen, and we had so many close calls. We just knew that sooner or later, some of the people on our ship were going to be lost, and there was no escape. That's the thing when you're in the Navy, there's no place to hide.
April 16th started out like a normal day at sea aboard the USS Laffey.
You get up before sunup, and you were on battle stations so that your eyes could adjust to the light, and you'd be ready to go.
Then, on the horizon, the dreaded silhouette of a kamikaze appeared. Then another, and another. They just kept coming.
Then they started coming in numbers. And once they started coming in numbers, then we started taking some hits. There was a plane that hit just forward of my gun. We had one terrible gasoline fire, not just inside my gun, but on the lower decks in the handling room as well.
Fires raged, then suddenly, out of nowhere, a second kamikaze crashed directly into Dulewski's gun mount 53.
When this plane hit on the blind side, it blew me up the deck maybe 15, 18 feet. When I woke up, I was draped over one of those depth charge racks on the side of the ship.
Of 13 men in his gun crew, only 7 survived. That day, the Laffey withstood 80 minutes of hell. 22 kamikazes attacked the warship, and 31 sailors died in the fiery wreckage. Gun 53 was ripped to shreds.
The tremendous concussion that took place and how it took those like quarter-inch steel and just opened it up like a can opener on both sides of the gun mount.
Larry Dulewski lived to tell about surviving 2 kamikaze strikes. His nerves were never the same, but he knows he's one lucky gunner.
I've always felt like I had a guardian angel. Always. To this day, I feel like I have a guardian angel.
Back on Okinawa, soldiers and Marines would soon be needing guardian angels of their own.
At first, American ground forces on Okinawa didn't encounter much enemy resistance because the Japanese simply weren't there. They'd gone underground. A hidden Japanese underworld of caves and tunnels ran more than 60 miles under the surface of Okinawa, setting a hellish death trap for the soldiers and Marines. Coming up on War Stories.
April 1945, the battle for Okinawa, so easy at first, took a sharp, bloody turn for the worse.
When we started going south and started looking into the eyes of these fellows coming back, we started to understand, hey, we've run into something. We've run into a buzzsaw.
Within the rocky hills of southern Okinawa lurked a deadly hidden enemy, over 100,000 soldiers of the 32nd Imperial Japanese Army.
What Nishishima, the Japanese general, had decided upon was to, instead of trying to meet us at the beach where we had this overwhelming firepower, he decided to meet us on the southern end of Okinawa, an area of about 10 square miles.
He was a brilliant commander. He did all he could do to use all the natural obstacles and caves and everything to set up his defenses.
Did they expect to be able to beat the Americans on this island, or simply to inflict massive casualties?
I think they expected to inflict major casualties. They knew what had happened in the Pacific. They knew that its time had come.
Soon, our troops saw evidence of the Japanese general's plan in action.
We were walking down the road going toward the lines, and they were coming back from the lines, and these trucks after the first one passed, we noticed that they were stacked with dead American soldiers, and they were loaded on there like wood.
There's an old military axiom, always hold the high ground, always take the high ground. Well, he had very effectively done that.
The first major confrontation at Kakazoo Ridge, the Army's 96th Division was fighting one hill at a time and suffered almost 3,000 casualties in 4 days. Private Herman Buffington was there.
We would go up to take it, take the ground, and they would be moved back in those caves and the bombing and whatever didn't stop them. They'd come right back out. Here they were facing us. And it's pretty much suicide.
The only ones you'd see were the dead ones.
Because they were fighting from underground? Or
the camouflage was great. The use of the terrain was great.
April 12th, a major loss far from the battlefield stuns the troops on Okinawa. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was dead after serving 12 years in office.
The first reaction was, who's president? And they said, Harry Truman. And they said, who in the hell is Harry Truman? Because nobody knew him. Nobody knew who he was.
Days later, war correspondent Ernie Pyle was heading for the front line with the GIs of the 77th Division. His dedication led him straight into a crossfire.
He was moving more towards the battle zone, and he was with a commanding officer, and a Japanese machine gun opened up on their vehicle, and they both jumped out and got into a ditch. Well, Ernie raised his head up. Bullets pierced his skull just below the rim of his helmet, and he was killed.
All the men wore their helmets with greater care as the fighting started to heat up on southern Okinawa.
I used to never like to wear that helmet because it was heavy, and I didn't like it. I'd wear a baseball cap lately, but down there, I wore that helmet.
Casualties mount to 3,000 a day as the GIs and Marines get bogged down in a bloody stalemate on Okinawa. That's next on War Stories.
May 1945 on Okinawa, the last bloodiest battle of the Pacific. The fighting was escalating, and so were the number of casualties, over 20,000 dead or wounded.
Driving through powerful Jap fortifications, armor smashes forward and enemy strong points are cleared out with flamethrowers.
The same psychology of most soldiers in combat, whatever army they're in, it's going to happen to the guy in front of you, the guy in back of you, but it's not going to happen to you. But that philosophy was hard to hold up on Okinawa.
Sometimes it might take 2 or 3 weeks to take one spot. You would usually crawl over Japanese dead bodies and this type of things, and to take those held, and you'd have to have enough people left to hold the hill once you took it. You got to have enough to hold it because they're going to have a counterattack on you immediately.
The pressure was on 10th Army Commander General Simon Bolivar Buckner.
Of course, there was pressure. The Navy at times was losing a ship and a half a day to these kamikaze attacks. And, you know, let's get it over with on one side, and the other is don't waste lives unnecessarily. We lost an awful lot of people anyway.
Private First Class Herman Buffington ran into the general on the front line.
This gentleman kneeled down and asked me, he said, "Soldier, how's it going?" And I told him, "Very well." And he said, "Well, could I borrow your rifle and shoot some?" I said, "Yes, sir, you may." And he said, "I want you to tell me if I'm still a pretty good shot." And, you know, just like out at the firing range. So, and that's what I did. And he was good. He was a sharp shooter. He was great.
He was right down there on the front many times, seeing what was working, what was not working, and passing that information back and forth among the Army and Marine units, kicking rears where necessary and praising where necessary.
Japanese General Ushijima commanded the 32nd Army, far below Okinawa's ancient Shuri Castle. His underground headquarters was 110 feet down with walls 4 feet thick. Marine historian Bennis Frank was there.
Shuri Castle, that was the center of the operation, the Japanese operations. The defenses that the Japanese had, the crossfire that they had, the amount of weapons that they had,
really created a problem for the 10th Army.
He had 110,000 Japanese and Okinawan soldiers dug in. Some of those caves went down 3, 4, and 5 stories.
They were probably among the best soldiers in the world. They were very fanatical, totally, absolutely fanatical. They didn't surrender, and we didn't take any. We wouldn't have taken them anyway.
Meanwhile, kamikaze pilots continued their reign of terror on the sea off Okinawa.
The Japanese expended a lot of valuable resources and aircraft that couldn't be replaced and pilots that couldn't be replaced and so on. But you have to remember the dark day that they were in and the period of the feeling of desperation.
The crashing suicide planes turned Allied warships into floating infernos. They would kill almost 5,000 American sailors. May 8th, VE Day. 5,500 miles away in Berlin, the defeat of Nazi Germany encourages the sailors, soldiers, airmen, and Marines fighting on Okinawa.
The Nazis began the ruthless bombing of cities. The Allies finished it.
We were very happy to hear that it was over in Germany because we knew we were going to get lots more help and the war would be over a lot sooner in the Pacific. That was a very happy time for us. And the next day, we started going up Sugarloaf Hill.
The hills around Shuri, that would defend the approach, were well fortified and were the scenes of some horrific battles. And those hills, dotted with these Okinawan turtleback tombs, connected with tunnel systems and natural coral cave systems to slow down the American advance.
May 11th, General Buckner launched a counterattack against the Shuri Line. The fiercest fighting on Okinawa was just beginning.
And many times reached a point of hand-to-hand combat, but we would throw, you know, a battalion at the hill. They would take horrendous casualties. We would push the Japanese off the hill. They would throw a large counteroffensive at us and take it back. So it was constant seesaw back and forth.
Heavy rains transformed the battlefield into a sea of mud.
What were the rains like in 1945?
Miserable.
Did the monsoon work to the advantage of the Japanese?
I would say so. It just about slowed down the operations of the Americans. I mean, there were quagmires all over the place. You're slipping and sliding. It made replenishment of ammunition and food difficult.
The ground became so soft that you could not dig a foxhole. You put a poncho down to keep from drowning.
Soldiers and Marines helped keep each other going.
One of the greatest things was the people you were with, because you develop a camaraderie, you develop a friendship. And the biggest thing in your mind is, I cannot let the guy next to me down.
We were the single guys. We're rather protective of the married guys. Now, this sounds, you know, we really wanted them to survive because they had children, and we felt, well, they better survive more than we should.
For those who survived, the battle for the Shuri Line was unforgettably gruesome.
You never forget the stench and fighting like was on Okinawa, because you're fighting over the same piece of turf day in and day out. You cannot evacuate, you cannot get rid of the dead, and there is a smell that you can't describe it, but you never get it out of your nostrils. It's for the rest of your life, you remember it.
Near Sugarloaf Hill, Marine Private Dan Barton was almost killed by a Japanese mortar round.
Our sergeant came up and asked me if I was hit, and I said I didn't know, because when the shell hit, it just kind of lifted you up off the ground and just... You back down again, and you're kind of dazed and shook up, and you don't know exactly what's going on. And I put my hand back, and it was bleeding. And so I laid down on the ground, and I took my pants out, and he was putting a compress on my hip with sulfur powder. And about that time, a shell hit behind us and killed him and wounded me. I got 2 pieces of shrapnel through the chest. Well, the worst part of that is we were pinned down, and we could not move. Anybody stood up, they would cut down my machine gun fire. So I had to lay there all day and shoot myself with morphine.
But that night, Dan Barton was rescued and evacuated from Okinawa. He'd later receive two Purple Hearts for wounds in action.
I remember laying in that hospital when we got to Guam, and I said, hey, I my whole saying has been home alive in 45, and I'm going to do it, and I made it.
According to Bushido, the Japanese warrior code, there is no surrender. A soldier must take his own life rather than fall into the hands of the enemy. That's next on War Stories.
May 31st, 1945, after 2 months of brutal fighting on Okinawa with over 50,000 American casualties, the soldiers and Marines of the 10th Army secure the Shuri Line.
That was in the 6th Marine Division area of operations. They hit it again and again and again to take the castle.
Japanese General Ushijima was forced to retreat further south. Imperial headquarters refused his request for assistance, but his 32nd Army soldiers were determined to fight on.
They were imbued with this spirit, emperor worship, tremendous nationalism, ready to commit suicide by going out against the guns of the Americans.
The Japanese booby-trapped not only dead bodies, but they also booby-trapped cave and tunnel positions.
Pockets of resistance remain. Troops fought house to house as fires raged in Naha, Okinawa's capital. 10th Army Commander General Simon Bolivar Buckner had victory in his sight.
There was no question in his mind that they were going to win. We had taken enough of the island that we had operating airfields. So how do we end resistance? Well, we just blast them out.
A second amphibious landing by the 6th Marines on the Oruku Peninsula finished off Japanese naval forces on the island.
Naval command was there, and also it held the city of Naha. It was a very well-done operation. Matter of fact, people on Okinawa could see how the 6th Division was advancing, how they were encircling Japanese troops.
On June 11th, General Buckner sent General Ushijima a message urging him to surrender.
Said something to the effect, one general to the other, we're both infantry generals and we want to save lives, and the best way we can save lives and is for you to surrender. When the Japanese saw this document, they laughed because it just wasn't the Japanese code.
June 18th, General Buckner inspected the newly arrived 8th Marine Regiment. It would be his last visit to the front lines.
My father went to the 8th Marine Regiment. It was a newly commissioned regiment. It was an observation post that he wanted to see how they were doing. It was in the afternoon, early afternoon, that a Japanese artillery unit opened fire with their last ammunition, as I understand it. And there was just one casualty, and that was my father.
General Buckner died on the battlefield, the highest-ranking American officer to be killed in action in World War II. His son, Cadet William Buckner, was riding a train back to West Point when he heard the news.
I thought I saw something on a headline down at the end of the railroad car, and sure enough, it was the headline that my father had been killed. That was where I learned about it. Well, what are your thoughts going through your head when your father's killed in battle? It's he actually said he always wanted to die with his boots on.
Marine General Roy Geiger took over command of the 10th Army and made history.
General Buckner thought so highly of General Geiger that before the operation commenced, he issued instructions that should anything happen to him, General Geiger would take over the Army. And so it happened that Major General Roy S. Geiger took over command of the 10th Army, the first time a Marine officer had commanded so large an organization.
Miles away, while under attack, General Ushijima got the word about his adversary's death.
He got word that my father had been killed. Well, his staff thought it was the best news they had ever heard. Not so Ushijima. Ushijima was very grave and very moved.
Ushijima and his chief of staff, Cho,
yeah.
both very experienced.
Yes.
Highly respected by the emperor. They decide that they can't face defeat, or they've decided that the destruction of their army requires that they commit ritual seppuku.
They both recognize that the cause was lost, the battle was over, and they had embarrassed themselves before the emperor. So they had a ceremonial feast. Each wrote a poem or a salutatory message in haiku. They were dressed in their white robes. They went out to the front of the cave and knelt and disemboweled themselves. As they did so, there was a lieutenant with his samurai sword who chopped the heads off of each of the generals.
Both generals were dead. The island of Okinawa was declared secure. But would the remaining Japanese soldiers ever surrender?
There's a cliff on the southern end of that thing when all ran around the end of it. And they were jumping off of that. The civilians were jumping off of that. And that, to us then, that was okay.
The atom bomb finally brings Imperial Japan to its knees. Next on War Stories.
June 22, 1945. After 82 days of brutal combat, the victory flag flies over Okinawa. The beginning of the mop-up campaign. Horrific carnage. 200,000 dead Japanese and Okinawans.
Well, here you have these, very carefree, loving, warm, friendly island people who are caught in the middle between this firestorm between Americans and Japanese. You know, entire villages were wiped out in Okinawa. Not one surviving ancestor or heir of an entire village. And the Okinawan people suffered horribly.
Soldiers and Marines rounded up Japanese prisoners and, where possible, cared for the battered Okinawan population.
As we pushed the Japanese and the Okinawan civilians further south, there was extensive, cases of suicide where Japanese women, Okinawan women, would throw their children off Mabuni cliffs and then jump after them.
There were casualties right to the bitter end. Private Herman Buffington took a piece of shrapnel the last day of the battle.
I was hit in the leg, and it hit in a spot where it went right out of my knee, and it went to the bone and stopped there. It fries just like cooking bacon. You can hear it. And yes, it hurts. It does hurt.
In spite of its ghastly losses on Okinawa, Japan still refused to surrender.
If the Japanese insist on continuing resistance beyond the point of reason, their country will suffer the same destruction as Germany.
Victory brought no rest for the weary troops. They received orders to prepare for a land invasion of Japan.
We knew we were going to Japan. We'd been taken out of the hospitals and we'd put in separation centers, going back to our outfits, getting ready to invade Japan. And this was a horrible, horrible thought.
The thoughts I had at the end of the Okinawa operation were that I undoubtedly was not going to go home right away, that the war was not over, and that we were going to have to invade Japan, and I probably wasn't going to survive the landing on Japan.
Meanwhile, in the New Mexico desert, the first successful test of a new weapon, the atomic bomb.
Harry Truman was very much impressed by the number of casualties Americans suffered on Iwo Jima and on Okinawa, and was determined not to have that in the invasion of Japan.
From Potsdam, the Allies warned Japan, surrender or suffer the destruction of your homeland. Still, the Japanese won't bend.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
August 6th, the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. No reaction from Japan.
I've been asked many times, what do I think about dropping the atomic bomb? And I say to those people that I feel like going digging President Harry up and shaking his hand again. But it was the finest thing to us in that position at that particular time that could have happened.
August 9th, Nagasaki becomes the target for the second atomic bomb. 5 days later, Emperor Hirohito was finally forced to relent. Japan unconditionally surrendered.
The bloodiest war in history finally comes to an end. Next on War Stories.
September 1945. After 3.5 years, it was finally over.
I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government.
Aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay, the Japanese formally surrendered.
The Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers will now sign on behalf of all the nations at war with Japan.
I could not believe the Japanese would ever surrender. Ever. I still couldn't believe it. They announced on a PA system that the war was over. And you would probably think that we went out and jumped up and down the streets and threw our hats up. Nope, didn't do it. That was the quietest place as you'd ever want to be in.
I had the strangest feeling. Here I was, a salty Marine. As I got close at home, I wanted to go back to my unit. That was my home.
Today, 56 years after the end of World War II, Okinawa is our strategic linchpin in the Far East.
The uneasiness between the U.S. and China and Taiwan, North and South Korea. So the Okinawan island, once again, could be thrust into another historic period should something erupt in the Pacific again.
Most of us, we wouldn't want to do it again, but we're very proud we were there.
If we'd invaded the Japanese mainland based on the bloodshed at Okinawa and the other brutal battles of the Pacific Islands, officials estimate that we'd have suffered up to 1 million American casualties and 2 million Japanese. But thanks to the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who fought in blood at Okinawa, we didn't have to. Thousands of them gave their lives to save millions of others. Theirs is a war story that deserved to be told. I'm Oliver North for War Stories. Good night.